So, welcome back, everybody. It's been a fairly long break. In the meantime, we had our intensive here at Ratna Ling. I'm up here for another reason now, but I'm in the same room that we had the intensive in, and I thought that went very well. And I hope to see some more of you. Let's see, when I do a TSK retreat in England at the end of August. I'll also stop in very briefly at the Nyingma centers in Germany and Holland, so I may see some of you then. Okay, so I think we're ready to start our session. So we're starting a new session, and we're finishing up, I guess you could say, the. Someone is creating noise here, and I can't tell who it is. And since Kathleen's not here, I also can't really control for it very easily. But the noise has stopped now. Okay. So what we're doing actually is finishing up a sequence in which we did space for 6 weeks and then time for 6 weeks. And now we're doing knowledge. And, you could think of it in terms of second level, space, time, and knowledge. I'm a little uncomfortable with that myself, but that is the way it's presented in When It Rains. So I have to take responsibility for it. Okay, I think that's Ken. Ken, I'm going to mute you. You can always. You can always speak up if you have something to say. Okay, that extra noise that I'm trying to deal with. Okay, so we're starting the knowledge section, and it's roughly speaking second level knowledge. And so I really spent a fair amount of time this week thinking about how to present that. So in When It Rains, it talks about the logos as being the equivalent of the field. In second-level knowledge, if I remember correctly. I don't have it right in front of me. But I started thinking about space and time and knowledge. And in When It Rains, it suggests that conducting time is the second-level dimension. So there's the field, is second-level space. Conducting time is second-level time. And then the logos is second-level knowledge. My own sense at this point is that rather than speaking of conducting a second-level time, it would be good to think of it in terms of the story. But that doesn't matter too much for us right now. We've moved on anyway. We're talking about knowledge. But it is kind of helpful to have a sense of how we can compare and make connections at this level. So there's the feel of the field, and then there's what I was talking about is the embodiment, really, of the story or living the story. And then in the orientation that I sent out a couple of days ago or posted a couple of days ago, I talked about the logic of the logos. But in thinking about it more, there are reasons to speak of the logic of the logos as kind of the second-level dimension. But really in terms of connecting with second-level knowledge and the way that the material unfolds and the way that the vision unfolds, I think it makes more sense to talk about the life of the logos. Because what happens is the logos gives us a certain order, and we're going to talk about that in quite a bit more today, a kind of temporal order. And we are in that order, and it really is our living reality. So the story is also our living reality, and the field is, in a sense, our living reality. But I'm trying this one out. We'll see how it works, and I'll refer to it as we go along. So I want to start with the reading from Knowledge of Time and Space, and then we will take a look at the reading from Love of Knowledge. And at a certain point, I also want to refer to dynamics, which is, we'll get to that. Okay, so when we start with the chapter from Knowledge of Time and Space, it introduces the idea of a logos, and it talks about logic here, talking about the self as the bystander. This is on page 19, and it says the self claims the right to possess what time presents, assuring that time's momentum will take form in accord with a specific logic. And then it says this logic, in turn, is informed by a logos, which is coherent and internally consistent. So the logos is a kind of an order, and it's another way, it's the knowledge dimension, you could say, of talking about the way things are. The logic of the logos, let's stay with that term for right now, points toward a self. So the logos that we operate with or in is a self-centered logos. And of course, we've explored that in a variety of ways in the course so far. The thing about the logos, say, in comparison to a field, is that it has this very tightly structured quality, it seems. So a field, the very nature of a field is that it's open to other possibilities, right? And so we talked about the feel of the field, and if we can really engage that feel, the feel of it, then we open to other possibilities. In principle, that's true for the logos, and that's what we want to be exploring, really, this term. How can we go about doing that? But to begin with, the logic of the logos is really compelling. You know, this notion that we have a self at the center, so still on page 19, it says, this logic is informed by a logos that names and defines, confines and eliminates. It establishes a structure based on a center and directions that extend out from that center. I'm going to stop there, but we'll continue with that paragraph in a moment. But there's something very kind of rigid about the logos. It's so clearly the way things are. We're so committed to it. And that makes sense if you think of it in terms of knowledge. You know, the world that we know is the world that's available through our knowing. There is no other world for us. So if the logos is what shapes knowledge, then we're kind of stuck. We're kind of stuck with what the logos gives us. Now, clearly we're not completely stuck, but it is the reason that both in this chapter in Knowledge of Time and Space and in Love of Knowledge, there's a lot of focus on the kind of negative limiting aspect of the logos. And then where we turn to after that is asking, how could we engage the positive side? How could we engage the potential for knowledge that the logos opens up? And that, again, in a general way, is what we want to move toward, and that's really what this whole unit now is about. So one of the really interesting points that gets made here, and this is where I stopped right at the top of page 20, it's something really fundamental. So this chapter, I've always felt that this chapter of Knowledge of Time and Space is a tremendously important chapter, in the same way that I'm very, very fond of chapter 5 of Love of Knowledge, for instance, and there's some other places. But one of the reasons that I find this chapter so important is exactly where it goes to right now. So we've talked about the logos, we've talked about it, how it sets up a structure which has a center and directions that radiate out, and that logic gives you a self in the world. But it goes on right at the top of page 20 to say something really important. It says, for the logos of self and world, what stands at the center of the structure is experience, the reality known to the self. So this emphasis on experience, I think, has tremendous ramifications, tremendous aspects for understanding what knowledge in the TSK vision, what it's all about. What we miss, because it's so fundamental, is that the reality, the relationship that the self has to the world that it inhabits, is that the self experiences that world. Sometimes we could talk about knowing a world, or we know, I know something in the world, I know an object in the world, but that's just a special case of experiencing. The fundamental point is that we experience a world. And as I say, it's so fundamental that we say, well, sure, what else could we do? But experiencing is tied up with the whole notion of a self that's at the center and that reaches out to know a world. And the way that it reaches out is through experience. And so experience here is a knowledge term. And the significance that it has is it makes knowledge into something really broad. The concerns of the self, the emotions that we have, are expressions of the logos, but they manifest in terms of experience. And that puts limits on what we can know. And so the logos is really an expression, you could say, of those limits. But the limits are much broader than or much more embracing than our usual sense of what counts as knowledge. I think that's one reason that Rinpoche uses this word knowledge, and it helps to think about why he uses it, because people complain about it. You know, people say, well, why not time, space, and wisdom? Time, space, and knowing, which is there are reasons you might want to do that. But the point here really is that we have a certain way of knowing the world, and that way of knowing the world is that we experience the world. And one of the advantages of talking about experience is that automatically or immediately we don't have to worry about the distinction about the subjective realm and the objective realm. You know, I experience my emotions in the same way that I experience being in this room or being on this this class, this webinar. Experience is a very broad term, and it's a tricky term in the sense that very often people say or people imagine that the goal of being on a path or looking for a different kind of understanding is to be able to experience in a different way or to be able to experience more directly. So we cut through our conceptual knowledge and we go to the immediacy of experience. And that makes sense from a certain perspective, but Rinpoche is really going deeper than that. He's saying that the very idea of experience is tied to a particular logic, a particular logos, and it's the logos of self and world. And as long as we imagine that the opportunities available to us are all mediated, are all only available in terms of experience, that in itself is a limitation. So it's very difficult, really, to escape from the notion of experience. And we use it all the time. And very often, as I say, we use it in a positive sense. But it's not positive from the TSK perspective. I don't really want to say it's negative. It's just that it involves or just automatically leads to a set of limits on what's possible for us. So what we would like to be able to do is actually question our commitment to experience as our way of knowing the world. And that's part of what I think is being talked about here. And it really is, it's all kind of implicit in this sentence at the top of page 20, where it talks about what the fact that what stands at the center of all of the structures that give us our world is experience, because that's the mode, that's the way in which we know the world. So the logic of the knowing that the Logos makes available is, you could say, a logic of experience. And that actually, I suppose, is one reason that I started thinking maybe logic is not such a good word, and why I'm thinking what makes more sense is to live the Logos. I mean, you might say to experience the Logos, but then you're already buying in to the limit that the Logos has imposed. In saying living the Logos, or if borrowing a term from the reading for next week, you could speak of embracing the Logos, and maybe that's a little better. I haven't decided yet. But if you talk about living the Logos, we live the Logos as experience, but that in itself is a part of the Logos, and we can move beyond it. So it's a really fundamental point, which is why I've spent some time talking about it. And I want to talk a little about the logic of experience of this particular modality. And this is what the chapter talks about. It talks about living simply. Right? Look, if you take a look at page 21, he says that the first paragraph, in this order governed by such a logos, people live for simple reasons, trying their best to satisfy their desires until eventually their life is used up. Time is oppressive. The experience is, or the logic of the experience is that by definition, by nature, it's subjective. These are all things we really take for granted. But when we begin to investigate what a logos is about, then the question really becomes available for inquiry. So one way that Rinpoche talks about this here is as a psychological model, which really means that experience belongs to a self, right? So there's involvement in identification. There's a kind of inherent tension. This is the whole description that you find in this chapter and also in the Love of Knowledge chapter. He also calls it a psychological mode. Let me see. So he says, chaos threatens behind each appearance. We don't really have I don't want to go into why he describes it exactly that way, but he does talk about it manifests psychologically in confusion and a sense of being lost, and that's what the reading from Love of Knowledge explores in much greater detail. We're cut off from time. There's a sea of emotions which can easily throw us off balance. That's, you could say, what leads toward chaos. That's the whole description here. But it all grows out of the fact that we live with a logos, a knowledge that manifests in a logos in which experience is fundamental. So I'm not going to spend more time. I guess maybe I'll say one more thing about this chapter, and then we'll move on to the reading from Love of Knowledge. If we look at the last, or the very bottom of the paragraph that starts at the bottom of page 22, it's talking about how this manifests in time as past, present, and future. We don't need to go into that right now. But at the top of the page then it says, the entities revealed within time, likewise exist in a way that divide their being across time, leaving the wholeness of their being inaccessible. A limited knowing reads out limited ways to be. And if we say, what is this limited way of knowing? Well, it's experiencing. And we don't think of that as a limitation usually because we think, well, of course, that's what the world is like. We experience the world. But that is only one possibility. So Klaus makes a point here. He says, since this chapter talks a lot about tension, Kumye might be a doorway to the knowledge aspect of TSK. Yeah, I think that's a good point. I've been helping to lead a retreat here at Ratna Ling for teachers from the Nyingma centers. And the other day we were talking a little bit about Kumye and TSK. And I said that Kumye is a way of exploring space. You know, it's a kind of a method of inquiry, a way of exploring space. But that, I think, is in a sense, really, you know, it's easy to understand that. The point you're making, Klaus, in this context, I think is a little more subtle, but really very interesting. When you do Kumye, and some of you don't know Kumye, but it's a kind of a slow movement exercise where you really focus on what we would ordinarily call your own experience, right? The word experience now is becoming a little bit problematic for us. I mean, it becomes a problem, and that's good. We should learn to think of it as a problem. But Kumye tells you to focus on your own experience, but it also says, and this is probably true of other movement practices too, that in the movements, you access a kind of experiencing, let's say, which does not belong to the self. And so at that point, in terms of what we've been talking about, you could say it's no longer experience at all, because in the way that it's presented here, experience always belongs to a self. So we move into a way of knowing our world which is not experiential in that sense. So we're using experience in an unusual way, I guess you could say. But I hope it's clear why we're doing that. So let's go ahead and look now at the reading from Love of Knowledge. And in some ways, it's very similar. It's interesting. It's always interesting to compare across books. And the vocabulary is often very different. But it still becomes worthwhile to do the comparison. In this case, the vocabulary is... Sorry, because I'm not at home, or not where I usually do the call. Things are not quite organized as well as I'd like, so I'm having to move things around a little. So here we are. We're talking about love of knowledge, and clearly, again, the focus is the logos. And the difference, I would say, is that in this chapter, more than in the knowledge of time and space chapter, we really start to look at how it might be possible to access the knowledge that manifests in the logos. The knowledge of time and space chapter is more focused on pointing out the limitations and the chaos and the tension and the tightness. Now, there's a lot of that in the Love of Knowledge chapter too, but we're starting to move toward the possibilities. So the starting point in the Love of Knowledge chapter is really to deal with fear, right? It talks about the self, the self fears that its existence may be called into question. So, you know, there's this image in this chapter, which is an image that I think sticks in people's minds, that the self lives in the world like an alien, you could say, you know, like a foreigner whose papers are not in order and is always afraid that its right to be there, the right to be in the country, is going to be questioned. And that's kind of the fundamental fear. And you know, because it is so fundamental, it's a little bit hard to verify that in your own experience, I think, because we don't usually go that deeply into our experience. What the chapter talks about is different ways that that fear can manifest. Now, if you actually want just some models for maybe understanding that fear, I haven't read this book in a long time, but I think Sartre's nausea, le nausée, might be a place where he really explores something like this. This existential fear. But what we get into in this chapter, what Rinpoche points out, is that many of the ways we have of engaging our experience are really expressions of this fundamental fear. And if you say, well, what is the fear? What is the basis of the fear in terms of the logos? It's that... it's put in a certain context here in Love of Knowledge, and we're not reading it in that context. But if we play it back into what we've been saying about the logos, it's that there is a kind of a recognition, although it's not acknowledged, that for the self and its experience to be at the center of the logos means that it's all kind of a construct. You know, something gets set up. The logos gets set up, and the logos has at its center the self and its experience of the world, and that's how we make sense of everything. But it's only a construct, so it could be questioned. That's the existential fear that he's talking about here at the beginning. But we want to look at some of the other examples that he gives. I think the first one, or one of the first ones he talks about, and we'll just go through these fairly quickly, is confusion, right? He talks first, actually, about preoccupation. If we start to look in a certain direction, we just lose interest. We get bored. So what he's saying is that there's an unwillingness to look at this structured nature of the logos, because it calls into question the fundamental nature of the self. Klaus asks, could there be a way of experience happening without an experiencer? And I didn't see that note when you typed it right away, I think. That we already talked about that pretty, I think, when we talked about the possibilities in Cumnier. So yes, I think there could be. It raises a kind of fundamental question, which I will get to in a few minutes, I hope, about, you know, how could we begin to question the logos? So one possibility is to look for ways of experiencing that don't have an experiencer. And from a TSK perspective, you'd say, well, then maybe they're not really experience. You know, maybe we don't want to use the word in that way. But, okay, the basic idea... of having experience without an experiencer. That would be one approach. Another approach would be, and I think this is more at the heart of how the TSK vision proceeds, and I think it proceeds this way in terms of the feel of the field and the embodiment of the story, and now you might say the life of the logos, and that's why I find it helpful to connect those three. You know, it gives us a kind of an organizing principle. We're still at the second level of time, space, and knowledge, but there's a fundamental shift that we're looking at, and it shows up in all these different dimensions. So this second approach, which seems to me more central to TSK, is to embrace the limitations, you know, to discover within the logos or in the manifestations of the logos the knowledge that informs the logos. You know, those limitations are themselves an expression of knowledge. And we'll talk about that more later in a few minutes, but also I'm sure throughout the next 6 weeks, because that's really a kind of fundamental response. But for now, we're still talking about the ways that we resist looking. The ways that the analysis which says that the logos is a structure, and the ways in which that analysis then leads us to a kind of existential fear, because we're just turned, we just turn out to be a kind of a representation of something or an expression of a structure instead of the most fundamental solid thing. And it's not the way that the self likes to understand itself. So we're looking at the responses. And one is to say, well, I don't really have time to look at that, right? I'm looking at the top of page 224 when it says, the self may simply respond with preoccupation, deciding that it has no time for such concerns or no interest in them. And so it just turns back to its usual ways of knowing. I don't care about that stuff. Let other people think about that. Or some other responses that are given here. A very central one is confusion. And the relationship between confusion and not knowing, I think, is really worth exploring here. As it says in the second full paragraph on 224, such a confusion is the self's version of the deep not knowing that challenges existence. So to understand how the logos operates is to invite an unknowing, a not knowing of our usual structures, because we say, "Well, wait, how do they show up? What's the source of our usual stories and commitments about existence?" And the right answer in terms of our usual knowing is to say, "We don't know." Because our usual knowing doesn't allow for asking that question. So the only right response is we don't know. But we don't let ourselves experience that not knowing, because that would take us to that level of existential fear. So instead, we just get confused. So he says here, when the not knowing at issue is fundamental, that is, when it deals with the founding story, the response is a kind of founding confusion. A response at bottom emotional. Right? It has its genesis in the specific knowledge that a story has in some way failed to cohere and has thus become unknown. So the not knowing that we're identifying here is fundamental in the sense that we are going to a level deeper than what we normally know to be true. So confusion is a response to that. So there's preoccupation, there's lack of interest, there's confusion. Rinpoche does name or explore a little bit another possibility here, which is very different. So those three are all ways of turning away or failing to acknowledge. But there's another move that he says we can make and do make, and it's actually quite challenging what he says here. He says we could also appropriate it. We could also say, "Oh yes, I now understand that my way of being in the world is really a construct. Now I see through that." And it's challenging because his point here is that the self reasserts itself in making that claim. It says, "Oh, I understand the self is a construct." What a beautiful, wonderful insight. How liberating that is. How fully it frees me from experience. And when we say that, we're affirming the self, or it's another way of not having to look carefully. So it's a kind of a a pseudo insight, you could say. It's the self's version of penetrating the stories of the self, or penetrating the logic of the logos. You could say it tries to penetrate the logic of the logos without first living that logic. So again, to play with this interaction between the logic and the living of the logos. So it doesn't really get to the heart. I'm not planning on talking about that right now. But Rinpoche certainly, you know, it's a short discussion, but it's one of those short discussions which makes a very fundamental point. So how could we begin to explore that? What we have is these different categories of being preoccupied, or we could say bored, right? Or being confused, or just feeling kind of fundamentally negative. And the suggestion that's being made here is that each one of those emotional responses as a way of experiencing the world is actually a potential doorway into understanding the real significance of the logos. That is the practice that I'd like to suggest that you do during the week. And there's a really good guide to that to that practice. It wasn't designed as an exercise, but it's very helpful. And that's exercise 3 in Dynamics of Time and Space. So I'm going to recommend that you look at that, and I'm going to point out a couple of places, a couple of passages in the exercise right now. It's on pages 252 to 257, actually, of Dynamics of Time and Space. But if we just look at the beginning of it, it says, look for a particular flavor within your experience or within your thoughts that's old and heavy, fuzzy or lazy and cloudy. It may not be exactly the same thing as the confusion or the preoccupation or the boredom that we're talking about here, but it's pretty closely related, I would say. And he describes it a little further on 253. He says, surface indications may include lack of motivation and enthusiasm. And he says, see if you can notice how energy drains away even as it arises. Within this dullness, there may be a painful feeling that goes toward agitation or lostness, vastness. So you can use this as a guide into the possibility of exploring in your daily experience the feeling which is being presented in this chapter as a doorway into understanding the limitations of the logos, or you might say embracing the limitations of the logos, right? And the suggestion that's made in the chapter is essentially to approach all of this playfully and to recognize your thoughts, your judgments, your emotions as being, in a sense, like random events. And I'm going to read you from the top of 254. The structure they compose, impose, and witness has no substance. It arises as they do. So just don't take that response seriously. It's actually a very simple practice. Don't take the response to the logos that's being described in Love of Knowledge. You don't have to accept the truth of that. And another place to look is at the bottom of 255 in the comment, in the top of 266. He says, what you're trying to do here is move away from the gravity of thinking, which we've talked about before. And you could also say move away from the logic of the logos, which imposes the truth of experience. And by imposing the truth of experience, it's imposing the truth of the self. So look at that. Just let it be there lightly. So that exercise, I think, is very helpful in giving a sense of what we would like to be, of how we could practice in an ongoing way. So that's kind of the walkabout practice. And it can help us wake up to our experience. You know, in the reading, Rinpoche says, if we do have an experience like this, we may immediately forget it, which is another way of protecting ourselves, you could say. He talks about not even, this is on 225, not even having room to recall what we experienced. So, you know, if that's true, it may be that we are steadily experiencing, or frequently experiencing, or sometimes experiencing this emotional reaction, which is itself a knowledge that goes deeper than the logos, right? Because we're responding emotionally or with our fear, ultimately, according to this chapter, we're responding emotionally to the structured and in that sense, kind of artificial nature of the logos. So it's a way of using emotionality as a marker for the limitations that the logos sets in place, the limitations on knowledge. And those limitations, again, have to do with experience. So this is the way, the kind of fundamental approach to doing inquiry, now that we're looking at this second level of knowledge. So we may not know exactly how to do it, but if we can let that not knowing itself be, you know, give rise to the kind of clarity, Rinpoche talks in the KTS chapter, he talks about not knowing as having a certain clarity to it, very different from the confusion, which is dull and heavy and foggy. So again, the playful quality can lead us into a clarity, in which case then our not knowing of how to go any further is a pathway for us. You might just compare for a moment, we're just about done, you might just compare for a moment the exercise that it's at the that comes at the end of the Love of Knowledge chapter. This is a version, a kind of simplified version of what in the first TSK book is the mountain retreat exercise, the one that people usually call the big sky practice. So it's basically a space practice, you could say, and it has to do with just letting in the blue sky. That's an even more simplified way of saying it. But the point is that if you can let space become more spacious, then the story becomes less convincing, and we can accept playfully the emotional responses that come when we commit ourselves in the usual way to experience. So those are some ways of looking and thinking about this topic. We didn't do an exercise today, and I actually wasn't planning on doing an exercise. Sometimes I just cut them out because we don't have enough time. But in this case, I wanted to lay out this very basic structure, and this is what we're going to be exploring during the next several weeks. Okay, so we're done for today. Thank you very much.